Hello, I'm Penelope Jenkins from the Knowledge Centre, and today I'm talking to Dr. Zara Newby, who's a reader in the Department of Classics in Ancient History at Warwick. Hello, Zara.
Hello.
You're a specialist on the visual arts in the Roman Empire, particularly athletics. How did this interest come about?
I'm particularly interested in what happens to the Greek world and its culture when it came under the power of Rome and became part of the Roman Empire. And because athletics was such a key part of Greek culture, so part of the culture that the Greeks themselves thought made them distinctive, it's a good area to look at to see what happens to Greek culture when it becomes part of the Roman Empire. And also looking at art also gives us a different insight to the picture that we might get from looking at literature alone.
Of course, there's no getting away from the fact that the 2012 Olympics are in London this summer. But can you tell me how different were the games in Greek and Roman times?
Well, there were a number of important differences, although I think there were also some interesting similarities, which I'll come on to in a moment. The main difference really is the religious context. In antiquity, the games were part of a religious festival in honour of the Olympian god Zeus, and they always took place at the same site, Olympia in Greece, so they didn't move around in the way that they do nowadays. And alongside the contests that took place, there were also sacrifices and hymns in honour of the god as well. The other thing that's quite interesting is the participants. In antiquity, the games were limited to Greek male citizens. So women were completely excluded, slaves were excluded, non-Greeks were excluded. So it was much narrower than we think of today. Although the definition of who was a Greek male citizen did change over time. So I'll talk about that in a moment, how it sort of broadened out. And indeed, married women were banned from even attending the games and watching them.
Why was that?
So it's not quite clear, because some people have thought that it might be because of the nakedness of the people taking part, but actually unmarried women were allowed. Although unmarried women probably means girls below puberty, so possibly there's something in that.
Yeah.
The priestess of Demeter was allowed to attend, so she was sort of exempt from this rule. And there are some nice stories about people who broke the rule. There's one about the mother of a sort of budding young athlete who wants to go and see her son perform. So she dresses up as an athletic trainer, wearing the robe of an athletic trainer. But she gets so excited when he wins that she jumps over a fence and reveals herself so everyone sees that she's a woman. But she's saved from the death penalty, which is supposed to be the penalty for breaking this taboo, because she has she's the daughter and wife and mother of Olympic victors, so this sort of status exempts her. But after that, there's a story that they said that any trainer who attended with their athletes had to attend naked as well, so they could guarantee that he was a man, he wasn't a woman in disguise. So it's a nice story there. Although the sort of exception as well to women not being able to participate is in the charioteering contests, because although women couldn't actually appear and act as charioteers themselves, often what happens with the chariot race, which was a very important race at the Olympics, is that hired charioteers are used, and the victor is the person who pays for the chariot and pays for the charioteer, but the actual person who runs the race isn't the person who gets named as the victor. So we have an inscription and a reference in the literary sources to a Spartan princess, Kaniska, in the early 4th century, saying she's the first woman to have won a victory at Olympia. But generally speaking, it's very much a male-only pursuit. I suppose the other differences are the contests that took part. Essentially, the ancient Olympics were made up of athletic and equestrian contests. So that's things like the chariot race and horse races. And then athletic contests such as running, wrestling, the pentathlon. So there were a lot less competitions than there are nowadays, and there weren't any team sports in the way that there are nowadays. Although there is one similarity in the fact that new contests were added over time, so they did sort of occasionally put new things into the Olympic programme and other contests dropped out. And they also had different categories for adults and for boys as well. So,
and if you won, was it the glory that you received or a medal?
You won a crown, which was a kind of wild olive, which was plucked from the sanctuary at Olympia. So mainly it was the glory. There wasn't any kind of monetary prizes for victory. Yeah. Although that said, you could often get prizes from your city back home, which were valuable. So cities were expected to recognise their Olympic victors, and also victors at things like the Pythian Games in honour of Apollo at Delphi as well, which was another important festival in antiquity. And they were supposed to reward them with things like meals at public expense, the best seats in the theatre, exemption from taxation. So there were monetary rewards, but they weren't direct. They were kind of an indirect result of the honour and glory that you'd won by competing there.
And what do we know about the changing fortunes of the Olympic Games over the course of antiquity?
I suppose the first thing to say is that it had a very long history. Often we tend to think about the classical period and the archaic period, which is the period we know most about from some of our literary sources and also from a lot of the vase paintings and things like that. But the games continued well into the 4th century AD, so throughout the Roman period and even sort of through the beginnings of Christianity becoming an official religion. So it's only really when pagan temples start to be actually closed and pagan religion is completely stopped that the games also fall into disuse. And our last, we don't know exactly when the last festival was, but our last recorded victors are in the 380s AD. So it carries on for a long time. I think one of the interesting developments from my point of view is this broadening of participation, of the way that people who take part in the games, who are all Greeks, actually the areas of the Mediterranean that they come from starts to change over time. So initially it's really the Peloponnese and the area around Olympia itself that produces the majority of the victors. So it starts off as a sort of local festival. And then in the 6th centuries, 5th centuries BC, the majority of the victors come from that area of Greece, but also central Greece as well, and also from South Italy and Sicily, where there were a lot of important Greek colonies. So those seem to be the areas that are sending most of their athletes and winning victories at Olympia. But over time, especially after Alexander the Great's conquests, because he conquers a large area of the eastern Mediterranean and founds Greek cities, and so do his successors, you start to find participants coming from those cities as well, increasingly. And then in the Roman period, the majority of our victors come from Egypt and North Africa, and also from Asia Minor, sort of Turkey, Syria, places like that. So it was still important for the central cities of mainland Greece, because our last recorded victors are two athletes from Athens. So that shows that, you know, the central cities, Athens, Sparta, places like that, are still sending people to the games. But a little about sort of 10 years before those two boxers, we've also got a reference to an Armenian prince called Varazdat, which is a very un-Greek name, taking part and winning at the Olympics too. So you can see that it broadens out. And I think that's to do with the way that Greek culture spreads after Alexander the Great, and also people wanting to sort of show themselves to be Greek. So if you get new Greek cities set up in the sort of far east of the empire, then those cities want to sort of show their identity by doing something that's associated with traditional Greece and with mainland Greece. But throughout there, it's a very important place for sort of stressing civic identity and civic prestige. So we find cities are very keen to kind of show themselves in rivalry with one another as to how many victories they've had and things like that. So the stories about people competing for successful athletes, for example, which in some ways is one of the similarities with the modern games. You often get these stories in the press about whether people should be part of Team GB or Team whatever, depending on their origins. And we've got similar cases in antiquity. There was an athlete from South Italy, Astilos of Croton, who is a famous runner. And his first victory, he says, he's from his hometown. And his second and his third, he says that he's from the city of Syracuse, which is an important city on Sicily. And the people back home take down his honorific statue and turn his house into a prison. And clearly so unimpressed by this that they're sort of almost, you know, destroying his identity back home.
Do you think he's been offered bribes then to change his allegiance?
We certainly hear about that. There's another athlete about 100 years later who is supposed to be the first of the Milesians, which is on the western coast of Asia Minor of Turkey, to win a boxing match at Olympia. And there's a story that delegates from Dionysius of Syracuse, this same city in Sicily, sort of tried to bribe him to say that he was Syracusan, and he said, no, I'm Milesian, and I'm the first of my area to win a victory here. So there are definitely references to bribery. And there are also sort of stories about people cheating as well in the ancient games. So there were a series of statues set up outside the stadium at Olympia, which were paid for. They were statues of Zeus, and they were paid for by the money that had been taken in fines from people who were caught cheating. And that was usually people who'd sort of agreed in advance who was going to win the boxing match rather than, you know, actually fighting it for real. So yes, there's certainly a fair share of stories about sort of malpractice going on, as well as glory and all the rest of it.
It's amazing, isn't it, that we know all this when it happened so long ago. Where does the evidence come from? How do your research?
It's a mixture of all sorts of things, as it is with anything with ancient history, really. Literary sources are really important. Some of those are directly about athletics. So we've got, for example, of Olympic victory odes by people like Pindar and Bacchylides, which were poems, songs written to commemorate particular victors. But we've also got lots of sort of passing references as well. Pausanias, who's a writer of the 2nd century AD, who writes a sort of description of Greece as he's travelling around. It's a bit like a modern guidebook. And he describes the sanctuary at Olympia and all the statues that he sees in great detail. And along with that, he describes the names of the people whose statues they are, so we can draw up a picture of the victors there. But we also have archaeological evidence, so inscriptions are really important. The bases of all these statues that were set up, mostly we've lost the statues, they tend to have been melted down, but the inscriptions say the name of the victor, his city, who set it up, when he was what he was being commemorated for. And sometimes there are statues in people's hometowns as well, so not just at Olympia, but places like Athens and all the rest of it. And then for sort of details of individual contests, visual art is very important. Things like scenes on vases, so that's allowed us to sort of recreate precisely how they threw the discus and how they threw the javelin and things like that. The fact that they held weights when they were doing the long jump and... so it's a jigsaw of lots of different pieces and putting it together. And of course, there are always gaps in our evidence. One of the other interesting things is that we've got sort of lists of victors as to who was the victor in the stayed race, which was the sort of the short sprint race in each year, because the Greeks generally counted in Olympiads. So the year of an Olympic festival, which happened every 4 years, gave a kind of common chronology for Greek history. Mm-hmm. So you'll sort of read histories that say, you know, in the third year of the 145th Olympiad, so-and-so happened. And that allows, because they then say the year in which so-and-so won the stayed race, the Olympiad in which so-and-so won the stayed race, that allows us to know the victors as well. But it shows how important the Olympics were in history, that this was their kind of common dating system, really.
You've written a book, Greek Athletics in the Roman World. Mm-hmm. You've talked already about it, but it'd be fascinating if you could tell me a bit more about how important athletics were in their Roman culture and festivities.
Yes, well, I think increasingly so, actually. I mean, the traditional picture tended to be that the Romans were a bit dismissive of Greek athletics, and they saw it as a sort of waste of time, and they were much more into warfare. And, of course, they were very interested in sort of violent spectacles such as gladiatorial contests and wild beast hunts and things like that. But actually, we've got lots of evidence to show that Greek-style festivals, like the Olympics, were set up in Rome and in Italy from the mid-first century onwards, AD onwards, and that these, that the festival particularly set up at the end of the first century by the Emperor Domitian, was one of the most important festivals. So on victory lists, they name it sort of just after Olympia, essentially. So it's up there at the top with Olympia as one of the most prestigious places to win a victory. And those were run along Greek festival lines. There were religious festivals as well, but the rules and the contests were the same as they would have been in Greece. We don't think that the Romans themselves participated in these festivals quite as much as the Greeks did. So most of the victors that we've got still seem to be coming from Greek mainland or Asia Minor, sort of Greek cities. But they certainly seem to be keen at watching them. And also they do seem to be keen at sort of doing athletics in the baths. So it's maybe a kind of more of a leisure level rather than a competitive level.
Yes.
So we've got lots of mosaics about showing athletes in the baths that sort of suggests that people like to imagine themselves as being like those professional athletes, even if they weren't quite. So... but at the same time, you know, it continues to be a very important part of the sort of the Greek culture of the Greek half of the Roman Empire, the sort of eastern half as well.
And did they do sacrifices in the Roman Games?
Yes, indeed, yes. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they're still a sort of religious contest, and the Capitoline Games set up by Domitian were in honour of the Capitoline Triad, which was Jupiter, Juno and Minerva, which are the equivalent of Zeus and Hera and Athena in the sort of Greek pantheon. So they're the kind of a Roman translation in a sense of the Greek Games.
Thank you. What are you researching next? What's next on your list?
Well, at the moment, I'm just finishing a book on Greek myth in Roman art, which is sort of continuation of my interest in sort of Greek culture in the Roman period. So not athletics specifically, but myths and the way they're shown in houses and in funerary art. But I do want to come back to festivals, actually, in a sort of subsequent research project. So to look a little bit more at how Greek festivals in the Roman period were used as a way to sort of assert particularly senses of civic identity and regional identity at a time when they're part of this massive global empire, essentially. So there are lots of resonances with kind of globalisation and how people keep their personal cultures in the face of a kind of multicultural world.
Thank you very much for talking to us today. Do come back and see what we're up to on the Knowledge Centre, as we'll be updating the site regularly with the latest research and learning materials.